Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply. Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
G&D, welcome back. Just after noon, you're locked into 106.7. The Fan second half of the show getting underway. It's a good thing your boy's not leaving the house today. Back-to-back Nats games. Caps playing a playoff game at 8 o'clock tonight. We're going to cover it all in the Beltway Blitz, by the way. But I'm wearing green gym shorts and a navy blue T-shirt right now. They don't match. They look awful together. The juxtaposition is bad, but that's what I'm wearing. And no one's going to see me but me. What about you, Danny? How you looking over there?
Traditional Redskins colors from the Jim Zorn era. Maroon and black.
Oh.
Maroon and black. It's not handsome. It's not a good combo. But we are maroon and black. And that's when I think of Redskins football and Redskins history, I think of the maroon and black.
Let's talk Washington football team and see what Pete Haley's wearing from NBC Sports Washington to kick off a three-deep Beltway Blitz. You can read Pete's work at NBCSportsWashington.com and see him on all of their broadcasts about the Washington Football Club. Pete, what are we wearing today, buddy?
You know, Grant, I can't say I expected that to be the first question of this interview,
right.
But I'll be open. I'm wearing a red Capital shirt, one of the shirts we got for at work when they went on their Stanley Cup run, and then really bright orange shorts, which is basketball shorts I had when I went to high school at Rockville. So I look absolutely trifling right now, and I'm glad no one can see me, too.
You're matching about as well as I am. The idea That's of just bright orange shorts that you wear like while you run at night so you don't get hit with that shirt is kind of funny.
Yeah, I look like a traffic cone, basically, with an ugly red top on. But it's okay, because I'm sitting in my room and no one can see me, and that's how I like it.
You were supposed to be at practice the last couple of days. You and the media haven't been able to go out there because they've been moved into the bubble. Are they actually going good on good yet, 11-on-11? I mean, we are less than a month from a game, and to my knowledge, they haven't really had, like, a scrimmage practice yet.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think we talked to Dwayne Haskins a couple days ago, and one of the things we asked, you know, is what are you looking forward to? And he said, I'm looking forward to going up against the defense in a competitive state. And it kind of all raised our eyebrows, like, you haven't done that yet? It's mid-August, and you still haven't faced the defense and tried out this new offense with all these new players? But I think that's just the reality of what phase two is. Ron Rivera has basically referred to it as OTAs. Phase three, when they put the pads on, will resemble traditional training camp, but right now they're still just doing the basic stuff. The team just put out a Twitter video of Terry McLaurin running a go route against nobody, and I think that's really all they're allowed to do and all they're planning on doing. So right now, yeah, not a lot of real footballing going on in Ashburn.
Pete, to me, the name was just a story to satisfy a lot of people. I don't really care what you call them. I care about this ownership dramatics. I care when billionaires are firing their legal missiles at each other. It's all happening. The dramatics to me are riveting. What do you make of the story?
They're riveting to me, too, as far as I can understand them. My dad is a lawyer. My brother is a lawyer. I made the really brilliant choice to go into the stable field of sports journalism and blogging and podcasting instead. But from what I read, yeah, it's pretty interesting. But I still side with that Dan Snyder will not sell the team. He'll not bow down to anybody or finally just give up. I think he's going to ride this one out. He's going to try to overpower people like he tends to do. And I think he'll be the owner of the Washington football team as long as he can be. I don't see minority owners being able to push him out. I don't see him just, you know, getting exhausted from all the controversy. I think he's here to stay. But that doesn't mean the battle won't be fun to watch and won't be interesting to follow, like you mentioned, Danny.
All right, Pete, you don't have to go deep into any of these. Maybe we'll get you back on over this next several weeks and we can break them all down. But just give me kind of your headlines, like your favorite on-field storylines from whenever it is that you'll actually be able to watch this football team play in the next few weeks.
I am wildly intrigued by Antonio Gibson's role. I'm very excited to see how much he's playing at receiver, what he's doing at running back, what kind of jet sweeps is he doing, is he being motioned, how often is he on the field. So I think that's my number one. of course, the obvious stuff like Chase Young and Dwayne Haskins matters, but Gibson, for me, is number one. And then just the D-line, the front as a whole. I know Danny just kind of poo-poos that and says it's a good group that's even more good these days, but I want to see how they're rotating. They keep saying they're going to really stick to that rotation and have guys playing 35 to 40 snaps instead of all 60. They want to keep everybody fresh. And kind of a subplot in that group is Ryan Kerrigan. He keeps kind of talking like, look, I'm a playmaker. We take advantage of Ryan. He's so nice, so we just ask him for quotes on other players in the front. But Ryan, to me, is coming across as a guy who's like, you can ask me about these dudes, but guys, I'm about to break the franchise sack record. I still matter. I still have a role. So I want to see what Ryan Kerrigan is doing on the defensive front on that side of the ball.
Pete, thank you, buddy. Always appreciate you joining us, man. Be well.
No problem. Enjoy your ugly outfits. I hope they carry on through the weekend.
Yeah, it's happening. It's all happening. Let's talk some Wizards, please, Tommy. Quentin Mayo, NBC Sports Washington, talks an awful lot of Wizards. That's why he's on the Beltway Blitz. Quentin, I don't know what Troy Brown is going to be. I just know that I liked what I saw of him in the bubble. What's his role? What kind of player is he going to be going forward for this franchise?
Wait. You're not going to ask me what I'm wearing?
I think that was how it was supposed to start, Quentin.
All right, fine. Let me back up. Hey, Quentin, what are you wearing, buddy?
See, I'm rocking a classic, just a black shirt. I got some shorts on, no pockets, okay? Real hoopers know we don't do pockets in the shorts. Got to get aerodynamic. And I'm wearing some gray Crocs with some Nike socks.
By the way, that's...
Socks and Crocs.
I was about to say, that's how you know I'm not a hooper, as if that's the reason I didn't, like, make it. But I've never owned shorts without pockets, ever, in my life.
When they show up and they don't have pockets, I get so frustrated.
Is it gym shorts without pockets? Yeah.
It's really inconvenient. Like, I don't know why I even said it. Like, it's a hassle. Every time I wear these on, I go somewhere. I have nowhere to put my phone, my keys.
Yeah.
But it feels good. I don't know. I probably should invest in pockets now that we're talking through this. This is a bad idea.
Well, all right. Now let's do the Troy Brown one.
Okay. Troy Brown, man, I've raved about him the entire bubble. I mean, he shows so many signs of what he can be in this NBA. And you think about the NBA moving to a positionless league. He's the epitome of that. He's young. He's long. He plays good defense on a team that plays absolutely no defense, one of the worst defenses in the NBA's history. But I feel as though he needs the ball in his hand to be effective. And if you're going to be on this Washington Wizards team in the coming years, you're going to have to learn how to do it without the ball in your hands. You've got a Bradley Beal superstar, should be an All-NBA player who's going to have the ball a lot. John Wall's coming back. They've got Ish Smith, a solidified backup point guard, under contract for another season. He's got to learn to be a catch-and-shoot 3-and-D guy, and if he can't do that, it's going to be tough to see where he, you know, goes in his career in Washington.
Quentin, I feel like I just kind of found out more about a girl I already kind of liked with Damian Lillard, and I'm just like now 6 months back on Instagram looking at pictures on the beach or something in a bikini. Like, I am so smitten with him right now. His post-game interviews are incredible. What he just did over the last three games was unbelievable. I don't even know what my question is, but I guess I'll just say Dame and then you can go, because that's what everyone calls him and acts like they're best friends with him. This dude is just – he's different. I love this guy.
No, he's absolutely phenomenal. And it's funny because I was texting with my group chat right before I came on just talking about who else could have done what Dame has done in these last few games. And we could only think of maybe, you know, Steph Curry healthy, maybe LeBron. But is LeBron hitting 9 threes? I don't think so at this point in his career. But Dame has been on a tear. And I just feel so good for guys like him. And we talked about this on Twitter, guys that who go through the pressure of having to win. People are saying they need to leave, ditch their home team, ditch the team that drafted them. Similar to Bradley Beal, leave and just ditch it and go join a super team or go team up with some guys. And he's staying there fighting for his life, fighting for his career, and getting W's. And I know that Paul George and Patrick Beverley beef fueled him even more, especially coming from Paul George. Like, Paul George's not even built like that. So don't take shots at Dame Lillard like he's not going to go out there and put it all on the floor. But I'm really happy for that guy. And I hope he gets the playoff playing W and continues to, you know, put people on notice around the league.
Whoever the champion is this year won't be the real champion because they won't have to go through Phoenix, apparently. 8-0 in the bubble, but they don't get to keep dancing. But let me get one more Wizards question in. Scott Brooks, his future with this franchise, do you think he's the man here going forward for the next, you know, 3, 4, 5 years?
I mean, he's in the last year of his deal. It's really hard to see. I know Tommy Shepard likes him. The players like him. They're really used to having Scott Brooks, but this year is going to be the final test for him. I mean, you kind of get a pass. in the season four of your contract because of the coronavirus, all the injuries that you're going through. But he started off really hot, and it's been a decline ever since then. So it's going to take a lot of digging for this organization to see, is he the guy? I think Scott Brooks has had a really successful career in the league. I think he's a great, great man. I think he has an offensive philosophy that could work for this team, but you can't have the worst defense next year in the league, anything close. You got to make it to the playoffs, and it has to be maybe 6 or 5 seed. I think anything under that, or if you get a first round exit, that's a failure. There's a lot riding on this season. Bradley Beal signed a contract extension, but he could be going anytime now. John Wall is in a fat deal. It's win or go home next season, and it's going to be a quick turnaround. So I hope he can get it done.
Quentin, enjoy the hoops all weekend. Hopefully we'll catch up soon, man. Thanks for joining us.
Appreciate you guys. And get you some shorts with no pockets.
I don't know if I could pull it off, I'll be honest. Although I do like the idea of that, Danny, because then I could maybe rock a fanny pack, and I would have to. And I've always wanted to be a fanny pack guy.
Big
I
fanny
just haven't had a
guy.
Reason to. So then I could say, well, I need somewhere to put my phone, and I can put
Where
it
else are you going to put it? Where else are you going
to
put it?
It's got to be a fanny pack. I've seen, like, ladies wearing them at King's Dominion and always kind of wanted to rock it, but it's just never been something I could do. All right, let's talk baseball. Byron Kerr, weird question, but we started the last two blitzes this way, so we'll ask you.
Got to do it.
What are you wearing today, Byron?
I got a GW basketball shirt on and some cargo pants with my black Under Armour running shoes.
They're very nice. By the way, nice dad move by Byron to go cargo shorts there.
Cargo shorts.
Just in case he needs to, like, put his hammer in a loop or something.
They're so functional.
You know he's got some kids he's rocking the cargo shorts. We're going to get to see Stras tonight against the Orioles and Tommy Malone, who somehow shut the Nats down last time they saw him. But before that, they got to finish a game. Can you just remind us what's going on in the game that gets finished today after 5 o'clock?
Yeah, it's not good. The Orioles are up 5-2 in the top of the sixth inning. They have two men on, and I believe there's one out, I think. But Sam Freeman was pitching that time, and he can't even pitch now because he's got a left flexor mass strain. He's probably out for the season and might have to go, you know, Tommy John if it's a serious situation. But the good news is that in that game they played last Sunday where they had the TARP debacle, Davey Martinez was not using any of his bench. So he's got his full complement of players available to start the bottom of the sixth. But they've got to get out of the situation in the top of the sixth. They're already down 3. And the Orioles have two men on.
So, you know, they're trailing late in this one. They got a chance to be 6-10 here. I mean, it's at a certain point, good teams play good. And it seems like every time they take a step forward, it's another kind of step sideways or step backwards, Byron. Kind of what ails this group right now?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, those first two games, Danny, you were watching them with me. They look like a team from last year where they were blowing people out or they were pitching well to win nail biters. And then the next two games, the Mets did exactly that to them. So, you know, there's a lot of situations it looked like Trey Turner was starting to come around. That's a good sign, but I don't know what's going on with Adam Eaton right now. He's not seeing the ball very well. And also his defense isn't very good. He kind of slowed up on a ball in right field, had another one go over his head. So, you know, the Nats need him to start playing a little bit better to get going. And you know, Eric Sames also has not hit a home run. So some of the power that they were expecting from some of these guys is not happening right now. And they're not having big innings. You know, in this series last week, the Orioles were the ones that had all the big innings. Four runs in the first game in an inning, 3 runs in that same inning or that same game. 5 runs on Saturday, 5 runs to help them take the lead in this game they're making up today. So that's the big thing right now for the Nationals is, you know, I pointed at the offense. They're just not having the big innings, and they're relying too much on their starting pitching, which has not been up to, you know, what we've expected in the past.
Byron, you've got that extra pocket down on the side of your leg just in case you need to store anything.
Damn
smart.
Right.
I like that.
Oh, I use all of them.
Take care, buddy. Good catching up.
All right, guys. Have a great weekend.
That you is too, your buddy. Beltway Blitz. 3 teams jammed into 1 segment on Grant and Danny here on The Fan. Before we get into some of the audio of Andrew Beaton of the Wall Street Journal on Dan Snyder versus his minority owners, which we could do at 12:30, Andrew joined us early in the show. Let's preview the Caps and the Isles. Haven't really gotten into them as much as we probably should. 8 o'clock puck drop, game 2. Sounds like no Nicholas Backstrom tonight. Let's give you all the details on that matchup next right here on The Fan. Developing but fascinating story in the Washington front office and ownership group. We'll play some of those clips and react to them coming up in a little over 10 minutes. Also, got to get into Juan Soto hitting a homer for the fourth time in 4 days, our daily Juan Soto appreciation segment. And we got to rank the best tight ends in football. Yesterday was payday at that position. George Kittle got signed while we were on the air. Travis Kelce got an extension after we were done yesterday. Who are the best tight ends in football? We'll both rank our top fives and see how closely they resemble one another. But let's get into the Caps and the Isles. Game two tonight to be played in Toronto at Scotiabank Arena. Caps are down 1-0 in a best-of-seven series. Puck drop is set for 8 o'clock. You can hear the game on 94.7 The Drive. That's our sister station because we got the Caps on 106.7 The Fan tonight. So listen over on 94.7. A couple of things, Danny. Number one, Nicholas Backstrom will not play. Todd Reirden saying he's got a concussion today. Now, whether or not he plays in game four, in game three, still up in the air. Nobody knows. But he will not play tonight after the dirty, potentially, cheap hit he took from Anders Lee that was late and when he didn't have the puck. Big loss for the Capitals. At least they get Lars Eller back, and Eller's role when they went to the Cup was to replace Backstrom in some games that year. They got by without him. Remember, I think they even clinched against the Penguins without Backstrom, if memory serves.
It feels right, yeah.
But still, I mean, he's one of your best players, man. He's a playmaker. He's a quarterback on the power play where they've struggled. They did have two power play goals and seven chances in game one. But that is a dagger. You're trying to get right, and you're going to do it without one of your hallmarks, your pillars, and backy.
It, you know, the cliche of other guys have to step up. You saw that on the Cup run. You know, Nathan Walker and a bunch of guys that are barely in the league had huge moments against Pittsburgh, the type of thing that Pittsburgh had done to Washington a million times over. Some dude you never heard of, all of a sudden it becomes unstoppable. Well, the Caps turn the tables. That's something like that's going to have to happen if they're going to not only get out of this series, but start making the run that we all kind of hope for without Nick Backstrom, at least for maybe a game or two. But you're right. I mean, it's the two-way accountability that Backstrom is just so amazing at, offensively creative while also being defensively accountable. And it seems sometimes, you know, for the most part, you'll get, you know, an effort three straight times. Then the fourth time, Jacob Vrana is just watching as the guy that he should probably be covering or close to skates in uncontested all alone and gets a nice feed and you know, smacks one past Braden Holtby. They've got to be really accountable. This Islanders team, they're not great, but they're not here to beat themselves. They're going to keep wearing you down and wearing you down until you make a mistake. They're like Iceman from Top Gun. They're not as talented as the Capitals are. They're just not. It's evident when you watch the game flowing back and forth. They want to muck it up and make you screw up, and they were able to do that in game number one.
Yeah, they were, and it was because for a couple of things. I think most notably that Braden Holtby was just nowhere near good enough in the last 22 minutes. And you never lose based on a player. And you can lose, I guess, in hockey if your goalie gives you no chance. This was not just a Braden Holtby story. But had he have played really well in the last 22 minutes, they probably would have won.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back through the four goals the Islanders scored, the fourth goal, which was just a defensive breakdown where he got hung out to dry and Anthony Beauvillier scored, nothing to do with Braden Holtby. The first three goals, I think, directly correlated to him doing something wrong. The first goal, terrible glove attempt at what is a save 99.9% of the time for Braden Holtby on the Jordan Eberle goal. And that was huge because you're up 2-0. End of the second period, either the Islanders go into the dressing room down multiple goals or now with all the momentum and they're a ricochet away from tying the game, which they would soon into the third.
They got
the second goal, a rebound issue. Now, Anders Lee scored that goal, who, by the way, knocked Backstrom out of the game with the hit early on, his second shift, I think, of the afternoon. But that rebound control by Holtby, normally a strength of his, bad in that moment. Rebound out in front is juicy, goes off Kempney, who struggled in the game, certainly not his fault in that moment, and then Lee bangs it home, it's 2-2. And then his biggest fiasco of the game, and just the unforgivable
terrible
mistake, was goal number three, the Josh Bailey goal, that same line, great pass from Brock Nelson, who had multiple assists. But that was the Holtby misplaying a puck, where he tried to drop it on Ovechkin's stick on the power play, rather than playing it behind the net like you learn to do when you're 4 years old. Your first pair of skates. That was just ridiculous. I couldn't believe he tried to do that. So three of the four goals, in my opinion, if he plays it correctly or normally, probably don't happen. And everyone said, well, he was great for the first 40 minutes. They had two shots in the first 20 minutes, the Islanders did.
Right.
You and I could have played goalie in the first 20 minutes. So he was pretty good for most of the second period, I guess. Then he gave up the bad goal, and he was terrible in the third period. But he's got to be better tonight. That's without question, my analysis starts.
Yeah, goals one and three, I'm going, you know, these are the major counts, right? Like, these are the you go to jail for a long time in the judgment court. Goal number two, you know, instinctive. You're right, it wasn't a great rebound. Too juicy. Fluky stuff happens. More of a pass. If that was the only goal he gives up, I'd go, oh,
yeah,
bummer.
Three,
you wish it had gone better.
That was the least egregious, for sure.
Right, that's a minor count, but it's still, in the playoffs, you can't have that. But those goals number one and three, inexcusable at this stage. Can't have that. So what's going to happen? I'm hoping that he comes out and his lights out, and that's sort of that. But, you know, I think it's all symbiotic. I mean, learned from Alan May and other guys that talk about this all the time. I think of how good you are defensively, and then there's this somehow your goalie's play continues to get raised up, right? For every time your defense messes up and you're left out to dry, maybe you feel like you got to do too much. Maybe you feel, you know, an extra set of pressure because you feel like you can't trust Kempney or you can't trust some of these other guys back there, whether they're going to turn the puck over, afford not to back check. I don't know. They need to play better for 60 minutes. What they did, I thought the first 35 minutes or so was going to be good enough to beat the Islanders. Was it good enough to make a cup run or do something amazing? I don't know. They were better than the Islanders, and it was evident. It was
well,
obvious.
Well, they played the Islanders game, which is what I want them to do in this series. Beat them at their own game. You can play that game. Barry Trotz was here before he was there, and he set that system up, and they have better players than the Islanders. So play them at their own game and beat them at it. The problem becomes, at even strength, if you can't get chances and shots, and then your goalie falters, say goodnight. And at even strength, they got outshot 20-11, 5-on-5. What are we doing here, Harry? One area where they've been great, penalty kill.
Mm-hmm.
At the risk of jinxing them, and I don't believe in jinxes, but I know a lot of you guys get bothered when we talk about things like this. I'm just going to keep doing my job and living my life. They were 4-for-4 on the penalty kill in game one. They were 7-for-7 on the penalty kill in the round robin. 11-for-11 now in Toronto since the reboot. The only team, I believe, in hockey who has yet to allow a power play goal. There were three teams coming into the postseason that did not allow a power play goal in the previous ramp-up games. So their PK has been masterful. Big Jonas Siegenthaler has been great. Carl Hagelin, who's a regular guest on our show, has been awesome. And you love the way they kill the penalty with John Carlson back protecting the house. So he was really good in game one. That's got to continue. The thing about game one, though, they got 7 power play chances. And they didn't get their power play going, luckily. They scored 2 goals with TJ Oshie down in front in that slot and beside the net. But you're not going to get 7 power plays in a game again this series. Just go in knowing that. That's not going to happen. The Isles aren't going to keep running around and playing with so little discipline with Barry Trotz screaming at them. So if you only get 2 or 3, you got to make 1 or 2 of them count. I mean, that's going to be the key, as we found out, because we know this. With Trotz coaching on that other bench, even strength ops are going to be at a premium. So when you get those chances with a man up, you better bury New York in this series.
Without question. It's not going to be easy. I mean, this is going to be a fight, and you saw some fights, actual fist fights, in this first one. But Trotz knows them inside and out, and the Islanders are here to frustrate you and bother you. I hate Kyle Clutterbuck. I hated him before the series started. I'm going to add guys to that roster. Anders Lee can go right to hell and singe for all I care. But yeah, there's going to be plenty more on that list before this is all said and done.
Grant and Danny on the Fan. Earlier today, we talked to the writer with the Wall Street Journal who's got details on the ongoing fight between minority owners and Dan Snyder and the minority owners wanting him to sell the team. You'll hear a couple of clips of what he had to say, and we'll react to that next. Reuben Foster is doing a Zoom call with reporters right now, the inside linebacker with the Washington football team, who they had high expectations for when they originally brought him in and thought he'd get healthy and be able to play. Well, last year, of course, he tore his ACL and his LCL when he was ready to make his return after being exonerated from having had domestic violence allegations and an arrest and issues that he had to overcome. And so he was just asked about that on a conference call, and it's perfectly reasonable. I mean, it's a major storyline with him. The team just cut Darius Geist. They've got this ongoing situation with how women are treated in the building, and so it's clearly going to come up. But his answer is very, very funny, and I kind of love it. It's a great quote. I don't really know what it means exactly, but it was just funny. Somebody asked him about his personality. I guess they asked him about the perception of him publicly. And he said, quote, "To know Ruben is to love Ruben. That's all I have to say." To know Ruben is to love Ruben. That's all I have to say. I think his point is anybody who knows me loves me, right? That's what he's
sure.
trying to say.
Sure. And that's the point. Very funny way to do that. And again, people get mad because it sounds like we're making light of something we're not. I'm just laughing at that quote. My favorite part is that's all I have to say, meaning I've summarized my views. But no further explanation is required at this time. This is you're looking for a summary. I'll say this very succinctly. To know Ruben is to love Ruben. That's the end. That's the end of my answer, because nothing else could possibly be needed to be added to that to further explain myself. That's the end. I love that answer.
Tom just sent me this, and I don't know why this is funny. Maybe I'm in a weird mood, right? I mean, because that maybe isn't that funny to anybody else. I saw that quote, to know Ruben is to love Ruben. And I just started texting people who were on the Zoom call, like, laughing about it. I think it's hilarious. This one might even be funnier, and I don't know why I'm so enamored with these quotes. So Tom just sent me this. It's from Sam Fortier, who we have on the show a lot.
Yes.
This is all it says. Linebacker Ruben Foster says he bakes swordfish about 5 times per week.
What?
Maybe that's not that funny. I hear that, and I think that's really funny. I don't like the
How
point
did that,
of that
come up? That's what I want to know. What was
on?
The question to get there?
What do you do 5 times a week that you'd like to share with everybody?
So it's got to be one of two things, right, Tommy? It's got to be, number one, the question could have been about his diet. Like, they're doing the you're in the best shape of your life bit. You know, he's saying, I feel great. I ate clean this off season. And then someone goes, well, what types of things do you like to eat? That could be it. Or it could be like, what do you like to do in your spare time? And then he starts talking about, I like to cook. You know, I bake swordfish about 5 times per week.
Yeah, what have you picked up during COVID?
Right?
Well, I bake swordfish a lot now.
Yeah. What are your hobbies? Well, baking swordfish. I don't know. Maybe I'm dumb. Maybe I think that's hilarious. Is swordfish a common fish, Danny? Like, I've never eaten swordfish or baked swordfish.
Yeah, it's pretty common, I would say. It's a
I'm sure it's
high-end fish.
I'm sure I can find it at Wegmans.
It's a more expensive thing. This might be a little bit of a hot take. I've always thought it's a little bit overrated. People rave about swordfish, and they do cartwheels, and they'd love to tell you how great it is. It's good. I'm not telling you it's bad, but it is not the thing that people should be doing, spin kicks and giant cartwheels for. But now enter people going, you've never had it prepared the right way with capers and lemon or whatever. I've had swordfish plenty of times. I'm a swordfish veteran. It's good, but we shouldn't be spending like $41 a pound for it, which is what people do.
Here's a question.
Pricing, but you get my point.
Here's a question. Chris Russell, I don't know how many listeners out there know that Chris Russell is like a secret chef, like homemade amateur chef.
Cook. Yeah.
Shockingly good at making certain things. Not salads, where he takes all the ingredients and then makes it in the studio and leaves a mess. But he's been known to actually do some solid cooking. Has he ever baked swordfish? That's what I want to know.
I'll ask him right now. I'm going to text him. I don't get the sense he's a big fish guy. I don't think he makes fish that often.
Even on his diet kicks?
That's true. I mean, I'm going to ask him right now, and I'll text him. But I
for a guy that pays 58 cents a pound for ground beef, I can't imagine he's going hard in the paint for swordfish. It's so pricey.
It's expensive, huh?
It's really expensive.
So I just Googled this, so I'm reading. And by the way, here's my prediction. You know that I'm not a fish guy at all, and other than salmon, I'd never really eaten anything until HelloFresh got me on Barramundi big time. And the one fish meal I've ever gotten in a restaurant is crab-crusted cod at Bonefish, which I really like. But this says swordfish is a mild-tasting white flesh fish with a meaty texture. It is sold exclusively in steaks. Its mild taste makes it particularly a good choice for those who are unsure if they like fish. It sounds like it's for me. It says substitute other meaty fish such as tuna, halibut, mahi-mahi, or salmon. Why wouldn't I love swordfish?
You would like it. It's again, people are going to take this the wrong way. It's good. There's nothing wrong with it. But, like, you could go and for example, our friends at Omaha Steaks, and I love Omaha Steaks, a 6-ounce swordfish, like 8 6-ounce swordfish is $70.
Really?
You know what I mean? Like, yes.
For one, you said?
No, for 8 6-ounce fillets is $70, right? You go to a restaurant, and, like, they'll do this little tiny swordfish fillet, and it's like $18 a pound or something like that. I don't know the exact prices, and I'm not in tune with the fish market. But you get the point of the dude's story. It is, people think of it, they're like, oh my God, the swordfish. Swordfish is good. Swordfish is good. I think you would like it because, as it says, that's correct. It's pretty mild. It's very accessible, even the non-fish people.
You're not really a big fish guy, though, in terms of
food. No, I'm a huge fish guy.
But not at home. You don't eat it a lot, I feel like. No?
I think we eat it a fair amount. I always let me clarify further. I always ask for fish because it's healthy, it's variety, it's not chicken. I've eaten a billion pounds of chicken. I'm so sick of it. I'm sick of chicken. I'm sick of turkey. Right, trying to do this diet thing that we're all doing all the time. I ask for fish all the time. My wife doesn't like making it because everything smells like fish, and that's not that much fun when it smells like fish for a while, especially during the preparation and the like. So we don't eat it as often as I would like. I ask for fish constantly. I would eat 10 times the amount of fish that that we do because I'm a big fish guy.
But do you bake it 5 times a week like Reuben?
No, I'm not Reuben Foster. To know Reuben is to love Reuben.
To know Reuben, to love Reuben. Reuben Pfeffer, Reuben Foster. Tommy, you've got an idea I think we could pitch to our sales staff, which might be able to grow some fins, as it were. What do you got?
Well, you know, baking is something that baking swordfish is something that Reuben Foster is into. We could find a way to do it outside, do a social distancing swordfish bake.
A swordfish bake.
A swordfish bake with
idea.
Reuben Foster. We sell
five
it.
Times.
We sell it to a grocery store, and we're within the guidelines of what we have to live our life by now. And then you can also try Big Swordfish, Grant.
I would love it, and it seems like he would be good at preparing it as often as he's been working on this during COVID times. So, yeah, why don't we do that? Let's get somebody on that, a socially distant swordfish bake with Reuben Foster as soon as we're allowed to gather in some capacity. I think that makes a lot of sense. I don't know why those things were funny to me, but they just were.
Five times a week.
5 times a week. That's so much swordfish.
Should I vary it up because I had swordfish the last 3 days? Nope.
Imagine eating that again. Every single day. And then the other thing to know Reuben is to love Reuben. Remember that important quote of the day.
That's all I have to say.
All right, let's get into our interview earlier with the writer and reporter from the Wall Street Journal. He's got the deets on Dan Snyder being at war with minority owners. You'll hear some of that interview. We'll react to it on G&D in a moment. Grant and Danny on the Fan, we will talk about the on-field product for the Washington football team at 1:30 with Nikki Javala of the Washington Post. She was a part of the Reuben Foster press conference. How much of an impact can he make on this defense? Plus, on the other side of the ball on offense, who's going to be the number two wide receiver opposite Terry McLaurin? We'll ask her those two things coming up today at 1:30. Right now, though, I want to get back into a segment we did in the first hour, the writer from the Wall Street Journal who had the report that Dan Snyder is fighting with minority owners and that they want him to sell the team was on the show to talk about his report and his story. His name is Andrew Beaton. Here's what he said about what he reported in the Wall Street Journal today.
Well, we've heard in recent months that the three minority owners in the team who have about 40% of the team have been looking to sell their stakes. It's also been clear that there are some tensions between the parties and that they have been attempting to pressure Dan Snyder to sell his stake in the team. You know, minority stakes become a lot more valuable if the entire team is being sold. And when you tick through all of the headwinds that the organization has faced in recent months, and it's not difficult to understand that there would be a lot of tensions, a lot of butting of heads. And there's definitely a belief that they are pressuring Dan to sell. But the important thing to also realize is he has no intention of doing so. He has no reason to believe he should sell. And he doesn't want to be pushed out like this. I mean, you can read the statement from when he was talking about the renaming of the Washington football team, where it's talking about a name that the franchise can be proud of for the next 100 years. He's thinking about this not just for himself and the rest of the time he owns the franchise, but potentially his children and beyond that. So there is this tension, there is this pressure, but Dan Snyder is hanging on and saying, I plan on staying the majority owner of this franchise.
Andrew Beaton of the Wall Street Journal. We pushed and went a little deeper into some of the bad blood between he and the minority owners, one of whom was helpful and responsible in making him change the name, by the way. Another who Snyder thinks may have been trying to get companies to say things publicly in the media that weren't true about him. Now, this is what Beaton said.
I think that's right. And it is interesting because clearly when this partnership began, and that has played out over the years, this wasn't always the case. But it is something that has deteriorated over time. One of the things that's interesting is Fred Smith's decision to sell isn't just over the last couple of months. He's wanted to do it for over a year. And he at one point even thought he had a deal for his stake, only for the buyer to eventually buy a stake in a different NFL team when he felt that the process was moving really slowly in Washington. And more recently, Robert Rothman and Dwight Schar have also looked to sell their stakes. But it's difficult to look at what's happened over the last few months without seeing the tension between the owners. I mean, one of the key straws that broke the camel's back in the name change was when FedEx, the company run by Fred Smith, called it out publicly. And even if you want that name change, there's probably some more diplomatic ways to do that. But doing so publicly effectively pitted the owners against each other publicly. And that is an uncomfortable situation. And then you have this legal filing that doesn't say it directly, but strongly suggests that Snyder's team thinks Dwight Schar could be involved in the defamatory campaign against him online. Again, that is not something that's proven. It's not said directly in the filing, but it doesn't take a lot of poking around to understand that that's where the trail of breadcrumbs leads. So when you look at everything that this organization has faced and look at everything that has happened, it's really easy to piece together a picture of significant tension between the partners that isn't getting prettier and, in fact, is probably only deteriorating.
So this happens because of, I guess, the feeling from the minority ownership is that Dan Snyder, listen, you could be as bad a guy as you want in a lot of different ways, but as long as everybody's making money, people just kind of quietly deal with it for the most part in businesses like this. Well, this has grown untenable. This doesn't happen in pro sports. And this is the thing that I keep trying to hammer as these months have gone on, is this is highly unusual. You are basically, if you're in NFL ownership in any way, all you have to do is sit there and the value of your asset goes up and up and up and up and up. It's basically quadrupled since these guys bought in the early 2000s. Talking about the three minority owners that are in this story and this kind of ongoing feud. They are so upset at Dan Snyder that they want out of this incredibly lucrative free money scheme. I mean, once you basically get in, there's no reason to get out unless you are so thoroughly disgusted and disappointed with the guy that's calling the shots. And I don't know what specifically got them to this point, but they're here now. And this feud is very, very real. You get Dan Snyder's side alleging that impropriety in terms of fake news or whatever the hell you want to call it, stories planted about him, Reddit threads gone wild, Indian companies that specialize in these sorts of crazy story planting things, alleged conspiracies with the daughter-in-law at a company giving a disgruntled former Snyder employee housing that was above her means and some sort of nefarious plot to plant bad stories about him. You get all these kinds of things that are taking place. The bottom line is this feud is very real. And I wonder what the end game is, what the realistic end game is for minority ownership. Do they think they've got a way to get Snyder out? Because otherwise this is just, you know, a temper tantrum kicking and screaming for nothing. That's what I wonder about. I wonder what's next for this group.
Well, what's next for this group in the immediate future is whatever happens in this suit he's got that's ongoing right now, where he's trying to get to a point of discovery so that he can try to prove, it sounds like, that he's got a minority owner who's trying by any means necessary to force him out, to get him to sell. And according to Snyder, that may have meant, seems like allegedly, him trying to get companies to disseminate fake stories about him. Look, here's one thing I will say, okay? While I will tell you that I think Dan Snyder's ownership has been largely disastrous, and I think that he's been guilty many times over of bad decisions and bad business, and we can question his character based on a lot of the things that he's done, I'm not going to sit here and necessarily just root for his oustering by any means necessary, if that makes any sense. Like, I think a lot of people are like, well, whatever shadiness it takes to get him out of there, so be it. I mean, to me, things have to be above board. Just as an example, the Washington Post story comes out about what's going on at the park. There was no implication of Dan Snyder in that. And people are like, well, you got to take the team away from him. Well, wait a second. There's a precedent here with the Dallas Mavericks where he didn't take the team away from Mark Cuban, who was really well-liked. And by the way, I don't remember a lot of people saying at that time they should take the team away from Mark Cuban. So just because you don't like Dan Snyder, and a lot of people don't, I understand that, just because you think he's done a bad job running the team, and I think most people probably believe that, doesn't mean that by any means necessary, whatever it takes, that he no longer runs this club, that someone else is the owner, you'll just turn a blind eye to it. It's still got to be on the up and up. Like, you still, I think he should get the same fortune that we all get in terms of defending himself and ideally not being scapegoated or, you know, not having people necessarily set him up in nefarious ways. I'm not saying that that's happening, for the record. That is what he and his attorney are alleging. Mm-hmm. Now we got to let that play out. But this is just, I don't have a better word than salacious. You don't see stuff like this.
Right.
In ownership in sports. And the fact that it's in our backyard and it's with kind of a villainous figure that people don't like. And this is incredible. It's really, really an amazing story. It's going to be a slow burn, too. So we're going to watch this thing play out probably for months and months. But, wow, is all I could say. It's fascinating.
It 100% is. And I agree with you in spirit in terms of I don't want any crimes committed to get Dan Snyder out. But I also would like the league to take these violations more seriously. The league already showed you what they thought of the long-standing culture of sexual harassment under Snyder. I mean, he's in charge of this. He's employing all the people that do this. And if you want to reap the profits, you need to reap some accountability. You've got the second layer of this with that nonsensical, ridiculous cheerleader scandal that happened that we've all sort of forgotten about conveniently. And the NFL, doesn't really seem to care about the owners at large. I wish he was punished more for this. I don't know if this rises to the grounds, as Andrew Beaton, who was great with us, by the way, from the Wall Street Journal earlier, I don't know if it rises to the grounds of what Jerry Richardson did, because he was directly involved, and it was terrible, what we were talking about there. But this is all under Snyder. All these, you know, you could read the Dave McKenna piece or otherwise. This is a bad culture that he's responsible
sure.
for
but
in some capacity.
Running a team poorly, having a bad culture is not the precedent to this point, as you know, as well as I do.
Right.
That is set for losing your team, is all I'm saying. So if you get Jerry Richardson and you're implicated and you were directly involved, yeah, you lose your team. We know that. If you get Donald Sterling and you do what he did, you deservedly lose your team. They would have had to set a new standard for him to lose the team. Surprising to me that they didn't do their own investigation and they're allowing the team to do theirs,
right,
to your point. Next on Grant and Danny, we had two tight ends yesterday paid. Two of the best tight ends, not just in the league right now, but maybe over the last 20 years in football, George Kittle and Travis Kelce. Let's rank our top five tight ends in the National Football League as of this minute, and we'll do that to kick off the final hour. We'll talk Juan Soto at 1:15, and we'll get an update from a beat reporter covering the Burgundy and Gold at 1:30 right here on The Fan.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.